following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
He's an American icon who fought in World War II, gave you Martin Lewis, Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Andy Williams, Fried Green Tomatoes, Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, The Declaration of Independence, People for the American Way, and a few TV shows.
Maybe you've heard of a couple of these.
All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Hot L, Baltimore, One Day at a Time, Mary Harmon, Mary Harmon, The Dumplings, All's Fair, All the Glitters, Fernwood Tonight, America Tonight, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, The Baxters, Archie Bunker's Place, Silver Spoons, Gloria, Square Pegs, a.k.a. Pablo, Who's the Boss, 227, Sunday Dinner, The Powers That Be, 704 Houser, Channel Umpteen and 3, One Day at a Time on Netflix.
All of the above with Norman Lear. It's all of the above with Norman Lear. What you do, you know that Norman Lear is just another version of you.
So, I understand my name to be Norman Lear, and I'm here because this is All of the Above with me and my pal Paul Hipp.
Hi, Norman.
And soon he will be arriving, the amazing William Friedkin.
The great Billy Friedkin.
Who we call Billy.
Yes.
His wife calls Billy. And... But I know him as William Friedkin.
You guys worked together.
A long time ago. We're going to talk about it because it's great fun talking about it. He's here.
Hey.
I see the man coming
in. Coming in the door.
Opening the door. Oh, my God. Are you William Friedkin?
Hi, Norman.
Hi.
Paul. Great to see you both.
It's wonderful to see you here and to talk about your new film. Which will be great. And your old film, maybe it was the second film I think you ever did. You did a film with Sonny and Cher.
That was my first one.
That was the first. That's
it's
what
pretty
I say.
Terrible and forgettable. But it was my Good Times.
Oh,
good
times. Yeah.
But I love them. They were good. I still see Cher.
But you know what I did with the title?
Oh, yes, of course.
Yes.
Yes, you had a series
with that title. I had a series with that title.
Oh, did you swipe that title from that?
I thought of it in this context only. Mm-hmm. I never remembered stealing a title.
Right, right, right.
But I'll accept that, what the hell, now, these years later. But why do you say that about the Sonny and Cher film?
It just wasn't – I didn't know what I was doing. And it was – a quickie because they were the number one act in America.
The number one
they had four or five songs in the top 10. And there were all these producers that rushed out to try and make a film with them.
Yeah.
It didn't matter what the script was, whatever, just get them on film and put it out.
You know what I remember? I wonder if you've remembered an evening where you and I and Bud Yorkin and Sonny played cards at the Sonny and Cher apartment.
Sure.
They were this giant hit.
It was a house
in
the valley.
House?
Yeah, Sonny had a house in Encino.
In Encino. Mm-hmm. And but I remember being served by Cher, who was there to serve us and see that we had a good evening for cards.
Wow.
Yeah, we used to play cards regularly. We had a big poker game every weekend, and we used to send out for clam zuppa, you know?
Uh-huh.
And whoever ate the most clam zuppa would pay for, you know, what we had ordered. But we'd just sit there and eat clams and pasta and play poker. Usually from Friday night till Sunday morning.
I wasn't a part of that. I was a part of this one evening
where
it was us.
She stayed upstairs and used to paint her nails. You know, she'd paint.
Cher.
She never got into his, like, private world, you know. He had a world unto himself, and she had her girlfriends. She was a teenager when they started. He found her at Ben Frank. You remember Ben Frank's on Sunset?
I do remember Ben Frank's very well.
Sonny had a girlfriend at the time and that he was living with, and he was a gopher for Phil Spector, the music producer.
Yes.
And Cher used to go into Ben Frank's, and she was basically homeless. And Sonny and his girlfriend took her in, And then they found that they had a lot of things in common, and they moved in together.
I wonder what our, you know, what the average age of our audience is, because if it's very young, they may not know a lot about Sonny and Cher.
Mm-hmm.
And Sonny and Cher, in my 95, oh, I can't believe every time I say it, in my 95 years, I don't remember a bigger hit. For the time that they were a big hit than Sonny and Cher.
They had this song, I Got You, Babe.
I Got You, Babe.
Which went through the roof.
Yes.
You know, it was huge. And then the music changed. And in came the Jefferson Airplane.
Yeah.
And the Doors. But Sonny and Cher used to play at the Whiskey A Go-Go. And then they were replaced by groups like the Jefferson Airplane, the Doors. And the Rolling Stones came along, and the music changed.
They made their demos, I think, on Phil Spector's downtime, because as you said, he was a gopher for Phil Spector. And Cher sang on a lot of those great Phil Spector hits. She's one of the background singers.
Anyone who came in the studio, Spector would have sing backup.
Really?
And Cher, they encouraged each other.
I could have broken that.
Cher used to say to Sonny, you want to be like Phil, don't you? And he would say, no, I could never be like Phil. I could never do what Phil does. Mm. And he would say to her, you really want to be a singer too, don't you? No, I can't sing. I don't. And Cher has always said that she learned how to sing by copying Sonny. Sonny would write the lyrics for her and teach her how to sing.
Really, what took him so early?
Sonny?
He crashed into a tree skiing in Aspen.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And he was a good skier.
Oh,
my. He was a good skier, and by then he'd become a member of the House of Representatives from...
I'd forgotten that.
Yeah, from Palm Springs.
That. Yeah.
And he became very prominent in the House. He owned a restaurant in Palm Springs and up here, and they were long split. Then. But they encouraged each other. And he hocked his electric typewriter so they could record I Got You,
Babe. He was doing better when he passed than he had been with Cher. He was doing with the restaurants and everything else. I'd forgotten that.
Well, he was, in the house.
He was a big business
man. And guys like Newt Gingrich and people used to come to him for advice on, you know, on what to say.
Who did thunk it when he was the straight man on that show with her, right? How did you come to direct that? You were a documentarian, correct?
I did a lot of documentary films when I started then and a lot of live TV. But Sonny wanted a young guy, and that was my only qualification, youth.
Yeah.
And we met, and we hit it off right away, and we had no script.
And you met Bud at the pretty much the same
Bud
time.
I met Bud Yorkin, your former best friend and partner, early on when I came out here. He was a great friend to me.
He was a great friend to everybody he was a friend to. He was a great guy.
Great guy. One of the best.
He's been gone some years now. Jeez.
It's hard to hard to realize.
Hard to deal with.
And you guys made all those shows together.
But then we made
listeners.
A film together, the three of us, called The Night They Raided Men's Case.
Yeah.
Which this guy directed and then didn't like.
No, I didn't think I did a great job on that film, as you know. I really didn't know what I was doing. You were a great mentor, I will say that. You were a great mentor and a tough cookie.
I love burlesque.
I know.
Tell me about being a tough cookie. I love that.
Yeah, how was
Norman
tough?
No. Well, you knew exactly what you want. You wrote the script. You produced it.
Yeah, I did.
And Bud was going to direct it, but your company had another film in the works in England that he went off to do.
Right.
I guess it was Start the Revolution.
Start the Revolution Without Me.
Something like that. And so he suggested that I really wasn't ready to direct it, you know, absolutely not. But so, and it is somewhat flawed, to be kind. But, you know, there's great stuff in it.
I simply disagree with you.
Okay.
I mean, flawed. Everything is flawed. I don't know anything.
Citizen Kane isn't flawed. There are no flaws in Citizen Kane.
Not a single one.
There's not a a wasted frame or sound or anything else.
It's, what other films?
But you're not taking into consideration what because if Orson Welles was sitting here, he'd have found.
Yeah, something. He might.
I doubt it.
Because that's the way we all are.
He knows what he did, Norman, and he knew what he did. It's the greatest film ever made. It's the film that got me to want to become a filmmaker.
Is that right?
I couldn't believe it.
You know, when he came back to this country, he was gone for a long while, and I think he was even. For reasons I can't remember, not welcome all that much. Maybe it had something to do with taxes. I don't know. But I got a call from him.
Really?
He had somebody had been sending him VHS copies of Mary Hartman, and he loved Mary Hartman, and he wanted to meet me.
Wow.
The most singularly memorable afternoon of my life in the years I was at Paramount was the afternoon that Orson Welles was coming to the office. And I never saw the place as excited. I mean, everywhere, everybody. The halls were crowded with people because he was going to be walking through them, you know. And then there was a restaurant we all used to have lunch at.
He used to go to Ma Maison.
That was the place.
Where he would eat for free.
Yeah.
And Wolfgang Puck was a chef there. It was owned by a guy named Patrick Terray, a French guy.
I remember.
And Orson would eat for free.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I thought he was picking up my check.
I loved his film, F is for Fake. That's my favorite.
That's pretty good.
That's
well,
a great
more
film.
Than Citizen Kane.
Well, no, I mean, that's one of my favorites.
Citizen Kane is just a masterpiece. To me, in film, it's like Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. It's flawless. It's the best example of writing, directing, acting, editing, cinematography, all blended into an incredible story with a powerful ending. And
let's invite everybody listening to come and see it with us.
Yeah,
we'll get a big theater. You know, I say that with no opportunity to do it, but if I could, how I would love to do that.
I still watch it, and I still get things from it. It's a quarry for filmmakers in terms of how to do it all, but you can never do it that well. That's the problem. First of all, it's the story, of course, as it usually is. But then the style, the tone, and the way he cast it.
It has a very strong, made a strong imprint. I remember it very well as you talk about it.
He went convincingly from the age of 25 to well up in years with a makeup artist that he had discovered who wasn't even in the union. Who was like a volunteer assistant, but who invented the concept of pieces, putting piece instead of just drawing on the face or putting a mask on. This guy would do pieces to age somebody or make them look younger.
How many films had Welles made at that point?
That was the first one. He was a stage director, and he had a network radio series. Mercury Theater on
Mercury
the air.
Mercury Theater, he did with Norman Corwin.
But he also had his own, the Mercury Theater on Broadway, which was part of the, when Roosevelt had sponsored the arts.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the things.
What was that program?
WPA?
You're trying to think of the program.
WPA?
WPA.
The WPA.
Yeah.
And the Mercury Theater was part of the WPA.
Oh, it was.
And he did experimental work in the theater before he ever got to make this film. He was going to – his first film was supposed to be Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, which Coppola then, many years later, adapted for Apocalypse Now. But Orson prepared a script of Heart of Darkness, and they could never, get it to his satisfaction. So Herman J. Mankiewicz, who co-wrote that script, knew the Hearst family. He had been in San Simeon. He knew the Hearsts and the family, and he supplied a lot of the background. But it's such a brilliant work. It's more than about Hearst, And it really is about the thing that nails it. It's more than just about itself. It's about the biblical idea of what shall it profit a man if he should gain the whole world but lose his own soul. That's the message of that film. And that's what happens to this character. Very convincingly, brilliantly. And so when I first saw it, I thought, geez, that's what I want to do. I didn't know what the hell that was or how to do it. But I thought...
How did you start to find out?
Well, but before that, I had seen movies on Saturday afternoon. Yeah. The Three Stooges, Boston Blackie, cartoons. There'd be, you know, 8 or 10 films in a theater for kids on Saturday afternoon. And I went into live TV, and I would very happily have stayed in live television had it lasted forever. Mm. And then I found a story about a black man in Chicago who was on death row. And I've quite by accident, as everything I've done has come to me really by accident. And I was told about this guy who was going to the electric chair. And I met the priest who was the chaplain of the Cook County Jail on death row in Chicago. And he introduced me to this guy, Paul Crump. And I made a documentary film that saved his life. It was his last writ of certiorari was declined by the Supreme Court of the United States. And when I met him, he was going to the chair in 6 months.
Wow.
And I made this film without knowing how to make a film on death row and with other aspects to it. And it was first shown to the governor of Illinois, a man named Otto Kerner, and who later went to jail himself. But he was at one time head of President Johnson's crime commission. But he was the governor of Illinois, and he saw my film, and he sent me a note saying, my parole and pardon board has voted to let Mr. Crump die in the electric chair, but I've seen your film, and I'm very moved by it, and I want you to know I'm going to pardon him to life in prison without possibility of parole, and I think your film is wonderful, and thank you. And later, Crump got out.
He did get out?
Wow.
He did about another 20 years. He had been in prison. He was the longest inmate in the country. He got out, but he didn't know how to adjust. He couldn't adjust.
Well, he had to be pretty old when he got out.
Yeah, and he was released to the custody of his sister in the same neighborhood where he grew up. And it was a very weird trial. It didn't matter to me his guilt or innocence. I thought he was innocent. But what mattered more is I was very much against capital punishment.
Yeah.
The state committing murder so coldly. And I actually...
How do you feel about it, Paul?
About capital punishment? I can't be in favor of it because though it's satisfying, the idea of it, and that's what they sell, one guy, there's always going to be that one guy that's innocent. And so it cancels out the whole thing.
Well, I saw a man die in the chair, and I've never forgotten one second of it. It was Paul Crump's cellmate.
Right.
And I was a witness.
Did we know he was guilty? See, the thing is, when you know they're guilty, somebody invades a home, kills everybody, does all that stuff, it would be very satisfying, you know, retribution. For people, that's what they pitch.
I would find it satisfying if I had reason to hate. And did it with my own hands. But just killing, you know, I mean, like somebody really hurt my child.
Right.
I want to.
Yeah.
I could kill.
You could kill.
Well, what they would
do. Or watch them die.
But I don't want to. I don't want my country in the business of killing.
Right.
Well, we do it in other ways.
Oh, you know, that we do well.
We do it in other ways. But to watch a guy die in the chair is excruciating. And there are three buttons. Three guys have their fingers on the button when the warden gives the signal. So no one guy knows who is responsible. But they hit him with 4,000 volts and then 3,500 volts and then 3,000. And what happens is when I watched this, it was behind, of course, a plate glass window. As he starts to cook, you see the smoke rising from his body, and his neck muscles go out like Dizzy Gillespie's cheeks Wow. playing the trumpet.
Oh.
And he turns beet red, and you watch him slowly cook. It was so disturbing. And I remember when I left the Cook County Jail and left the room of execution, out in the streets of Chicago at 26th and California, where the Cook County Jail was, there were thousands of cars, people lined up in the streets all around the jail, because the rumor was that when they pushed the buttons, you could see the lights dim in the jail. Hmm. These people just showed up to watch the lights dim, which didn't happen. Hmm. And then I remember his mother waiting in the doorway of the county jail to claim the body.
Oh, man. Talk about harnessing the power of cinema, though, your first time out. With the
well, that's what
getting
got
a guy
me into
off
film.
Of death row.
And Bill Butler was the cameraman. I later brought him out here. He photographed Jaws and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
William Butler.
Wilmer. His name was Wilmer Butler. Bill Butler. He was a live TV cameraman at WGN where I worked as a director.
And in the course of your work, you made a film that Paul Hipp was in.
A TV show. We did Tales from the Crypt.
Tales from the Crypt, a show called On a Dead Man's Chest.
Yes.
It was pretty good.
It was really good. It was 1990. Really,
yeah. What did you play?
Eight or so. A rock star, a guitar player.
Yes.
And my buddy, who's the lead singer of my band, gets a tattoo, and the tattoo comes to life. Hmm. The tattoo is, inhabits spirit, right? Mm-hmm. Inhabits this tattoo. And we had great people in it. Greg Allman.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols.
Right.
Remember Steve? These cameos we had. But it was great fun. And to watch you, Billy, come in, the first day I told Billy this, it was like I just followed them around as Billy walked around with his team and just kind of every angle, every shot, you had the whole show in your head before you even got started. And it was like
where was that?
A master class.
It was on HBO.
In Bill's career. No, in Bill's career.
Oh, well, this was, I mean, he's Billy Friedkin at this point, you know you're going into audition for Billy Friedkin, and then when Billy Friedkin hires you, you feel pretty good about yourself as an actor.
Well, the producers were Dick Donner and Joel Silver, and they asked me to do it.
I just bumped into Joel Silver yesterday.
Yeah, but we had a blast. I'll never forget, we were having lunch one day. We were shooting at a house in Venice, and they had base camp was in a parking lot there at the beach, and you asked me, did I know who Lever and Stoller were?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Lever and Stoller, the great songwriting teams of all time, and who wrote for, among many others, Elvis Presley, mm-hmm. who was my favorite.
They wrote Hound Dog.
Yeah. Your buddies. Mm-hmm. And then Jerry Lieber lived like half a block away.
On Venice Beach.
And you said, let's go over and say hi to Jerry Lieber. I was like, you kidding? And knock on the door, boom, Jerry Lieber, hanging out with Jerry Lieber, talking about working with Elvis and stuff. That was pretty amazing. But we had a good time shooting that.
It was great. Lieber and Stoller didn't like Elvis's version of Hound Dog. They wrote it for Maybelle Thornton.
Big Mama Thornton, yeah.
Big Mama Thornton. They wrote the song for her, and they loved it.
Yeah.
It was spot on what she did, and they thought Elvis's version was too Vegas.
But they ended up liking him as an artist.
Oh,
sure. They came to because they were ready to just, what is this? It's not our thing. We like these rhythm and blues artists. Who's this white kid faking it? And they got in the studio with him, and they were like, wow, okay, this is a real deal.
Oh, sure. It was – what Elvis did was a revolution.
Yeah.
Elvis shook the world, you know? And they later went on and wrote Jailhouse Rock, all the songs for Jailhouse Rock.
How much do you have to do with music in your films? Because, you know, like the soundtrack
everything.
To The Exorcist, I remember as a kid, when I was a kid and that came out.
Yeah.
That was the biggest record. And was that the first time a soundtrack was that big? Tubular Bells, Mike Oldfield, right?
Yeah, that's the largest selling instrumental song ever.
Do you remember that, Norman?
I don't remember.
I never met Mike Oldfield.
You're kidding.
To this day. And
He didn't send. Did he send you a thank you note or anything?
No. In his book, Richard Branson, who owned the company,
Virgin
Records.
It was the first release,
This was their first release. It was sent into Warner Brothers to see if they wanted to release it in America.
And
it was on a pile of stuff where you used to have like needle drops. It was a big 33 and a third, much bigger than the one you could buy in a store. And it was a demo. And I was looking for something that sounded like, but was not, Brahms' Lullaby. You know, some simple melody played on one instrument. And I found Tubular Bells. And Branson, in his book, says that's what made his company.
Yeah.
So he said that my use of that in that film made his company. And so years later, when I read his book, I sent him a note. And he owned this island in the Caribbean.
I've been there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I said, geez, you know, my wife and I would love to come to Necker Island.
Necker Island, yeah.
And he sent me a note back and say, I'll make sure you get the family discount. And I thought, the hell?
Did he?
No, I don't care. I was expecting he'd give it to me. He said the use of the song made his company.
Yeah, you started his empire.
Wouldn't you have given it to me?
I think I might have.
You know, but it was like $100,000 a day or some extraordinary, ridiculous thing. But no, I never met Branson or Oldfield, and that thing keeps going.
So the music...
100 years ago, I have to tell you, when you say, I never met Branson, Sir Richard Goldstein, Goldmark, he was a major figure, and he was a sir in London, and he had a big estate in Mexico. Sir Richard...
Oh, I know who you mean. Yeah.
Yeah, he was very well known.
Goldsmith.
And Goldsmith.
Yeah, Richard. Jimmy Goldsmith.
Yeah, yes.
Okay. James Goldsmith.
Oh, is that his brother? Because he had a brother who was an environmentalist.
Well, James Goldsmith owned the place in Correas, Mexico.
Yes, yes, yes. He invited us to come to Mexico because his brother was a major environmentalist, so was Lynn, and so we were invited and we went there for a weekend, and Richard Branson was there with his wife and two children. And oh my God, that place. We never had a meal in the same place. Every meal, breakfast, lunch, dinner, was in a different location. And a couple of them that we were bused to, that kind of thing. The last night we were to dress, everybody was dressed. Sir Richard was... Sir James Goldsmith.
James Goldsmith. It was his house. Yeah.
Yes. He was dressed to the nines. It was a gorgeous man anyway. And Sir Richard was playful and in the middle of the evening pushed him into the pool.
Charming.
Sir Goldsmith. Within 20 minutes, you couldn't see him, his wife, his kids. They were gone.
Wow.
Off the plantation.
Just really?
When the next morning I asked him,
ouch,
Sir Jimmy, or however I had called him, what happened to the Bransons last night? His answer to me was unforgettable. I was afraid I forget what you call them, deputies, or he had a police force there. He had a little town where the several hundred people who worked for him lived in this little town, had its own pharmacy, its own doctor, its own. And he was afraid that they would hurt him.
Hmm.
And so the family was shipped off.
He didn't get the protection. Joke. Couldn't take a joke, I guess.
Yeah. I had an experience. I went to Necker Island for a wedding, for Larry Page's wedding. They were playing tennis down on the grass, tennis courts. And I don't really play tennis very much. And so anyway, I just wandered down there and they were playing and they needed a fourth guy to partner up with Branson. And I said, I'm not very good. I said, do you play? I said, a little bit. They said, come on, you'll play. And I got into the game and I realized how competitive he is.
Oh,
because,
really?
Yeah, because I was fucking up every shot and he was just getting more and more annoyed with me. And I felt terrible. But anyway... towards the end of that trip, we ended up talking. And he was kind of a little difficult to get to know, but we ended up talking. I played guitar and sang a couple songs. We had a great night one night. And finally, he came over and saddled up next to me and said, "So, you're a very nice guy. How does a guy, you know," he started asking me about myself and I talking about music. When I was first got to New York, Virgin Records was the biggest thing there was. To me, it was, I mean, it was, they, the Stones ate everybody, right? They were the biggest record company. So I made a joke that was at my own expense. We were talking about, you know, music and back in those days. And I said, "Well, you know, if you maybe if you'd assign me," I sent millions of demos to Virgin and never heard back in those days. "Maybe if you assigned me, that record company of yours would have worked out," you know, joking, because it was the biggest record company. And he kind of turned and looked at me and said, "We were the biggest company in the world at one point." And that was the end of the conversation. And he never fucking looked at me again. When I got home, I read his biography and I read that that company built, but he lost it, right? Famously, it all went down. Like, he had to, in order to save the airline, he lost the record company. And I thought, to this day, I want to apologize to him and tell him, no, that's not what I meant. But he probably doesn't think much about me.
He doesn't need an apology.
Yeah, he's probably not thinking about me.
He's still doing very well.
And you don't need to lose any more sleep over that.
These are the things that keep me up at night. Yeah.
I wound up using, for the Exorcist soundtrack, though, I basically used excerpts from what was then contemporary classical music. Composers I'm sure you've never heard of.
Let's talk about the present Exorcist. The Devil and
Father Amort.
The Devil and Father Amort is a new film that Billy is coming out on the 20th, I think, of this month. And did you see it?
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
And
yeah.
I saw it too, and I was fascinated by it. The big, big question is, was it for real?
That is the big question. It's one of the big questions. It's all a matter of the mystery of faith. I mean, if you're a Jewish guy, you're not going to think you're possessed.
Do you know any Jewish guys?
One or two.
Yeah.
But it's a religious-based affliction. 99.99% of what's written about exorcism and possession is jive. And very little is really known about it. In the United States, there were two cases reported in the whole 20th century, because the Catholic Church doesn't really talk about it.
Exorcisms
or who's possessed.
Yeah.
It's not an entertainment. You know, it's not a public spectacle, and they say very little about it. Bill Blatty, who wrote the novel and the screenplay for the film that I directed, basically invented the modern concept of exorcism and possession.
Really?
To the extent that when I showed this to neuroscientists and psychiatrists in order to get them to debunk it,
which they didn't wholeheartedly do.
No, well, the brain surgeons said, "We don't know what this is. Everything originates in the brain, but there's nothing we could do with this woman's brain. There's nothing we could remove. This isn't epilepsy. It's not a lesion in the temporal lobe. We don't know what this is."
And it could have been an actor and a director.
The guy was for real. Father Amort was for real. He's the most spiritual man I've ever met. Now, I got to do this quite by accident. I had no intention of doing it. This was a case of possession and exorcism. It didn't work. This was a woman's ninth exorcism. But in that sense,
that was all real, Bill?
Totally. Of course.
But is it as real as having a room full of true believers believing that the construct of the whole thing? There's a room full of people with her, praying for her, praying with her.
Her family.
Her family. And they all believe
that she's possessed.
And they all believe that the priest and the exorcism is the only way to get it out.
What the priest is doing.
Doesn't that have a power in itself?
It has a great power. And when she walked into the room when I first met her, I wondered, what is this woman doing here? She was very attractive, like an Italian movie actress, 46 years old. An architect, and she would have these fits and attacks periodically. This was her ninth exorcism. She had gotten one a month. But he had been exorcising a man for 16 years. In that respect, it's not unlike psychiatry in that you don't go in for one visit and you're liberated or you're cured. Mm-hmm. Very few priests have ever even seen an exorcism. Very few popes have ever performed an exorcism. John Paul II was an exorcist in Poland, and he left three cases to Father Amort, one of whom he liberated, the other two he was still treating at the time of his death last year. But Blatty's book is fiction. It's a work of fiction.
But it was based on a
it wasn't based on anything.
So that's all from his imagination.
That building in which the kid lived, all of that was...
That story is unprovable, Norman. It's unverifiable.
If Blatty were sitting here, he would say it was true.
Toward the end of Bill's life, I think he had some doubts about it, because everyone who wrote about that case, it was a 1949 case of a 14-year-old boy in Cottage City, Maryland, and everybody who wrote about it had an axe to grind and something to promote. What Blatty was inspired by were the public reports of that case. The fact that it was on the front page of the Washington Post and other papers that flatly stated it was a case of exorcism and possession. Mm-hmm. And Bill thought, as an undergraduate at Georgetown then, that if this was true, it was religious nirvana. Mm-hmm. And so he set out to try and write about it as nonfiction. And the church, of course, wouldn't tell him anything. They don't. Yeah. They're closed mouth and should be. And so it took him 15 years to be able to start to write it as fiction. He made up all the characters. He made up the story. And he didn't use anything from the reported case.
You mean the devil never said, "Your mother sucks cocks in hell"? That's disappointing. One of my favorite
lines. That was Blatty. Here's what
remember
happened.
That from the movie?
When I started to show this to, like, psychiatrists, I had two psychiatrists say to me after they saw it.
When you started showing this recent
film? Yeah, the documentary.
Now film, yeah.
The documentary. And they both said in different words, well, it looks authentic, but it doesn't have the classic symptoms. She doesn't have the classic symptoms. And I said, well, what are the classic symptoms? And they said, well, her head doesn't spin around, and she doesn't levitate. So, these are two prominent psychiatrists.
Oh, my God.
And
all
from your film.
I said, Doctor, Bill Blatty made that up, and I had to find a way to film it. I don't know that that ever happened anywhere. There's no reports that I've ever seen that this ever happened. This Blatty invented the concept of possession and exorcism as we understand it today. Now, I told you there are two reported cases in the 20th
century. But what
about
the 500,000 exorcisms?
They're not 500,000 exorcisms, Norman. Between 500,000 and 600,000 people in Italy seek an exorcism every year. They don't all get it. And Father Amort had doctors that he worked with, brain surgeons and psychiatrists in Rome, that these people would have to see first. And if there was any kind of a medical, you know, solution to their problem, that was how it was handled.
Were they independent psychiatrists? Or
yeah, totally. People? Yeah, but guys that he believed in and dealt with.
So they weren't like Catholic Church.
And it was his cases that the people who wrote the DSM-4 and the DSM-5, which are the psychiatric manuals, they were allowed to study about 50 of his cases, from which they prepared. Now in the DSM-4, they recognize exorcism. If you go in and you say you're possessed, they don't say, no, we'll give you a little therapy and some medication, right. You'll be fine. They have an exorcist as well. And they call it dissociative identity disorder, demonic possession. And that's what's said in my film by four of the leading psychiatrists in the country. And I went to four of the leading brain surgeons
That was interesting, seeing the brain surgeons in your film.
They didn't know what the hell it was.
Yeah.
And I said, wouldn't you give this woman an MRI if she came in? No. This has nothing to do with her. There's nothing we could remove that would change whatever's going on with her.
So in exorcism, the demon has come in and taken possession of this person, but they can't make them do anything. They haven't taken over their free will, but they make them so uncomfortable. The idea is that they sin. Is that correct?
They have taken over their free will.
They have taken over their
free
will.
To one degree or another. And there's a woman in my documentary who was exorcised successfully by Father Amort.
Mm.
And she tells her story in the film. And she remembers, and her brother, who saw her writhing on the floor and crawling up the walls and stuff, took her to Father Amort, and he tells her story.
I don't remember. That's in the film?
Oh, yeah. This woman and her brother.
Before or after the exorcism we see?
It's before.
So when Father Amort goes in, he is going in as the agent of...
He's no longer going anywhere.
Well, no. I mean, when an exorcist goes to battle with the demon on behalf of God the Father.
What
and
he
the
believes
Son.
He's doing is calling on Jesus to perform the exorcism. He's just calling on Jesus. He's not doing it.
He's not doing it.
And Jesus will do it when and if he pleases.
So it's not the words of the exorcist that are compelling the demon to leave. Because that seems kind of weak. If you're talking about a demon that could cause war and pestilence and, you know, all this stuff, that you could compel it to leave by calling it unholy and different names. That's the question I always have.
They do more than that. The Roman ritual of exorcism is kind of a lot deeper than that. But it is calling upon Jesus to end this person's affliction.
Hmm.
And as I say, some of the cases he had were 16 years and not successful.
Right.
This woman was in her ninth month of it, not once a month for 9 months.
The woman in the documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's incredible about her is, as you said, she's such a sweet
face. She was lovely.
Face. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, is she cured or are we going to go back
and
see her? And then there's the film happens and the exorcism happens and the demon comes out. Did you do anything to the voice
nothing.
Of the demon?
We did nothing. All I did was record it.
Wow.
And I had no intention.
But there was another camera there. You say...
Not in that room.
Well, where was I looking at if not another camera?
I'm sorry.
That's right. We never saw... that's the one place we didn't see.
Let me tell you what happened.
We answer phones on this show.
And especially if it's Sherry, because she did the show.
No, I'm not going to... take that. I'm sorry. And I'll shut this off. I'm sorry that happened. Gentlemen,
I'm sure
it will...
Norman's liable to answer his.
For the audience that understood what I just said, Sherry Lansing was a guest here sometime ago.
Yes,
right?
She loved it.
And
she loved doing your show.
Yes, we loved
just
having
loved
her.
Yeah.
So...
And they're married is what I... is the full message.
So I never intended to film this. I was in Lucca, a little town in Italy, getting the Puccini Prize for operas that I had directed. I did...
Oh, I wanted to talk about that.
Yeah. I did like four Puccini operas, and I was getting the Puccini Prize. And I had to be in Lucca for 8 days, master classes and Q&As and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I went to Puccini's house. He lived there for 21 years, and he was the church organist. And there's a great history of Puccini everywhere in Lucca. But I had to be there for 8 days. And someone at a gathering I was at casually mentioned that Lucca was a 35-minute drive to Pisa. And I wanted to see the Leaning Tower, which I had never seen. And someone else said, by the way, there's a one-hour flight to Rome from Pisa. There wasn't from Lucca.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, I'm here for 8 days, too much, it's lovely, but who do I want to see in Rome? So I wrote to a friend of mine named Andrea Manda, who's a Catholic theologian, writer about Catholic issues. He's a friend. And I sent him an email saying, Andrea, would it be possible for me to get a meeting with either the Pope or Father Amort? And he wrote me back saying, well, the Pope isn't here now, but Father Amort would be delighted to meet with you. He had written any number of books about his work, and his first book, which went into 50 or more printings everywhere, he wrote about my film. And he basically said that while the special effects were over the top, it did make people, it helped people to understand his work. So he agreed to meet with me. So I took a day out of my schedule there, flew to Rome, met with him, and we had a wonderful meeting. It was in March of 2016. And I came back here. We went to the Vanity Fair Academy Awards party. And I was talking to Graydon Carter, who was the editor of Vanity Fair. He said, so where have you been lately? Have you done any operas? And I said, no, but I just got back from Rome. He said, what were you doing there? And I told him, he said, oh, you got to write this for Vanity Fair. I said, what? He said, yeah, you got to write about this guy. I'll give you as much space as you want. So I wrote an article for Vanity Fair that was 6,500 words. That was the whole... I went back and interviewed him again on tape, and I asked him, Father, would it ever be possible for me to witness an exorcism? Thinking, no, because they don't give permission to do that. Mm-hmm. The church never grants it. But he didn't need permission. He was the Vatican exorcist. His official title was exorcist for the Diocese of Rome. Mm-hmm. And he said, let me think about it. And a couple of days later, I got an email from his superior saying, all right, Father Amort is going to do an exorcist on May 1st, an exorcism, and you can come. And so then I pushed my luck and said, you think I could film this? Thinking, no. Word came back that I could film it, but without a crew and no lights, alone. And so I had a little Sony CX still camera that shoots high-definition video.
With a little mic on top, I noticed.
A Sennheiser mic attached.
Yeah, a little directional mic.
And I sat 2 feet away from them and filmed the whole thing. I made a couple of small cuts in it.
But who held the camera that was filming you filming?
There was no camera on me during that whole thing.
During the exorcism, there
was no. No, there's no shot of me during the exorcism. But later... When I went to interview the doctors, Norman, I had a very small crew, guys I'd worked with before, who filmed me and the doctors. But I filmed most of it with the Sony still camera, a GoPro camera, that little thing that's a tiny little cube, and a cell phone, an iPhone.
You shot some of that on your iPhone?
Yeah. All the point of view shots and everything.
Yeah.
And it looks great.
It looks fantastic.
You know, it looks good. But the technology is there. It's about what's in front of the camera now, always. But so I never intended to do this. And once I shot The Exorcism, to me it was like a home movie. I didn't know what I was going to do with it. I shot it because I could. And then I thought, well, let me take it to these doctors and see if they'll debunk it or explain it. And
you were off on a documentary.
Yeah.
That's where it all started.
That's how it did start. I swear to you, I had no intention of doing this.
I think it's incredible. Guys like you and like our friend Abel Ferrara, who's over in Rome. Mm-hmm. Abel just made a documentary about Padre Pio. Mm. He's using the iPhone. He's using, you know, a little video camera. And so I'm guessing you are a big fan of the democratization of the tools and
Absolutely.
The YouTube of it all.
Absolutely. And a young person or an old person can go out and make a film now.
Yeah.
Without having to rent, you know, tens of thousands of dollars worth of camera equipment and lights.
Yeah, you just got out and shot this thing.
Yeah. And it was harrowing to witness.
Yeah.
And I was terrified.
That's what I was wondering about.
I was terrified.
Watching the film is one thing. It's scary enough. When you were sitting that close to that woman and the demon comes out.
She was held down by five strong guys.
Who was the guy principally holding her down?
There were five guys.
But there was one guy behind her.
One guy. That guy behind her was Father Amort's assistant, who assisted him for 7 years doing that very thing.
See, that explains one thing where I thought I caught something, because I'm so cynical about it. I went to Catholic school. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking for any reason to... And I thought I saw him doing that thing that novice actors do when one person is speaking their lines, lip mouthing. That makes sense now.
I mean,
he would know the dialogue.
He knew the ritual.
He knew the whole ritual inside and out.
And he had attended dozens of them as Father Amort's assistant. And then there were other strong priests and her boyfriend.
Right.
Who was a big guy. And he was holding her down. There were five guys holding her down.
Yeah.
And she was coming out of that chair. And I didn't know what havoc she might cause.
Yeah. As a filmmaker, and I don't want to give too much away because people are going to see the film. But in the end, there's quite a scene that you describe, but you didn't bring your camera.
I didn't bring my camera.
And were you kicking yourself all the way back to Los Angeles?
Well, but Father Amort had died.
Right.
And she was alone, and she met us in a little church. She agreed to meet with me because I wanted to do what you call B-roll on her, which I didn't have. You know, footage of her life.
Yeah.
Her life in this little Etruscan town of Alatri, 200 miles southeast of Rome. And I went there to do this, and she agreed to be filmed. And she changed the time and place of the meeting several times. Finally, we met in this small, empty church in this tiny little religious city with oil paintings of the saints outside of every house.
Outside every
house. And I met with her in this church, and she was freaking out. I didn't take my camera in because I wanted to ask her permission to film, because she spoke to my Italian assistant on the phone and she was gone. And he said, I don't know what we're going to find when we get there. So I didn't want to walk in with a camera.
Right.
And she was possessed.
Fully possessed.
And she was shouting. Her boyfriend was saying, you cannot, in Italian, you cannot show this film. We don't want you to show this film. We want you to give us the film. And I said, I'm never going to give you the film. And I said, by the way, it's not a film. It's not even film. He said, oh, it's a memory card. I didn't think he knew what the hell. And I said, it doesn't matter. I'm not getting. And she was yelling in the demon voice, I want it shown. I want this shown.
Oh, shit.
And this was not her. So whoever that was wanted it shown. And they didn't.
Right.
Her family and her. Once they knew I had this, then they had second thoughts, of course.
Yeah.
But it was just a harrowing experience. He was holding her around the neck.
Right.
She was in
a folding chair.
Yeah,
and he needed to.
And he had his. He's about 6'5", heavy. And he was holding her down, and she was scraping and moving with him across the floor.
Yeah.
Coming towards me. And I just stayed there, and I said, I will never give you the film. Do you understand what I'm... Watch my lips. I will never give you this film.
That's Chicago
and
facing
I just
off
left
with the demon.
With my assistant, and we went back to Rome. We didn't say a word to each other. We couldn't
believe
it.
But you had a contract or whatever passed in Italy for a contract.
Well, yeah. She had agreed. But that wasn't the point. The point was that there it was, and I had felt by then that it should be seen for whatever it is. But I didn't know what to do with it. Take it to doctors then or whatever.
But you had – so you're face-to-face with the demon, which is telling you – and he's telling you he's going to find you and kill you.
Oh, he told me – her boyfriend said, if you don't give us this film, we're going to find you and kill you and kill your family.
Ugh.
And he belonged to a very powerful cult called the Pyramid Cult.
So the boyfriend of the possessed girl belongs to a cult.
Yeah.
What's that Thanksgiving dinner like?
it was a strange situation.
Wow.
The whole thing was strange.
I've heard you talk about the film gods. It sounds like the film gods put this whole thing together.
I had no intention of doing it. I was finished with the whole subject.
Right.
Blatty's film is fiction. I did a fictional film about exorcism. Neither Blatty or I had ever seen an exorcism, you know. And when we made the film, it was like total fiction.
Yeah.
And now I was able to meet Father Amort, who I'd heard so much about.
Right.
And he was willing to meet with me and talk to me and let me witness what was his last exorcism.
What you photographed could pass either way. If you told me it was fiction, I would believe it. If you told me you have no idea because it happened before your eyes and so forth, it happened before my eyes too.
Yeah.
It did, Norm. I don't know what this – everything relating to something like that is about the mystery of faith. You either believe in something or you don't. And I'm not a skeptic, as you may know. I'm not skeptical about – I believe, you know, as Hamlet said to Horatio – there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy, Horatio. Mm. And that's how I look at everything. Nobody knows anything about the eternal mysteries. Nobody knows anything, not the Pope, not Bertrand Russell, not the greatest philosophers.
I liked the Russell you had in the film. Not Bertrand, what was his name? The old guy at the beginning, his last name
was
Russell.
Oh, yeah, Jeffrey Burton Russell.
Jeffrey Burton
He's
Russell.
Written six books on the devil.
Oh, that guy. What a wonderful
guy. He did a life study about the devil and wrote six books.
And he looks like he has spent some time delving into the darkness.
Well, he told me, he said, don't mess with this stuff.
Yeah.
He said, the more you mess with this stuff, the deeper you get into it, and it will take you over.
But I am very glad, as this comes to an end, that we, because it has to, that we have
gone for hours.
This was the best messing with it that I know of.
Oh, I love talking to you guys.
I love
you. You know, I've loved you for many years.
Oh,
I love you as a person, as a producer, as a example of what a great life can be lived if it's a purposeful life. And you continue to do that.
I love you,
too. I'm certainly a big fan of yours.
I want you to come back and we talk about opera only.
Sure.
Over the years, I've been so astounded that you just came back from 6 months or 4 months or whatever the hell it was, and you did two operas in Hungary and one in Italy.
Oh, I did about 15 operas, Norman.
And didn't you direct your first opera not knowing anything about opera?
Of course.
So that's the way you did your film, started your film career.
Opera. Zubin Mehta, who's a friend.
Yeah.
Sherry and I were having lunch with Zubin and Nancy, and there's four of us, and out of the blue he said, why don't you do an opera with me? And I said, geez, Zubin, I've never seen an opera. And he said, no, I think you'd be very good. You know opera music. We've talked about it. I said, yeah, I know some scores, but I've never seen it staged. He said, what would you do if you had the chance? And I named one of the most obscure operas in the canon. It was one of two operas written by Alban Berg. And one is called Lulu, and the other is Wozzeck. And Wozzeck, I said, I'll do Wozzeck for you, knowing that they hate German opera in Italy, especially in Florence. And I thought I could put him off. He said, all right. He went out and he got his book, his engagement book, 7 years of bookings. And he said, all right, I'll do Wozzeck with you in Florence in 2 years if you commit to it now. And I thought, geez. And Sherry said, oh, go ahead. It'll be fun.
Wow.
And you did it.
I'd like to do Lulu. Lulu is great. Lulu has a great scene with Jack the Ripper.
Yeah. Wow.
Alban Berg. I've done Aida, which is on video now. I've done Aida twice. It was done in Oman last year. I did it in Turin, Italy. I've done operas in Munich, all over the world. Israel. I did Samson and Delilah in Israel. And then they put it on in Timna, where Samson and Delilah live.
Wow, in the actual spot.
Yeah.
Is there any demonic possession anywhere in opera? In an opera? That would be interesting.
Well, there's Mephistopheles.
Oh, yeah.
Two composers have written Mephistopheles.
Yeah.
But otherwise, no. They're much more benign, Paul.
Yeah.
We're going to come back and talk about opera.
And more film and all of it.
Great.
And all of it.
Great to talk to you guys. God bless you both. Thank you.
Bless you. Bless you all. This has been All of the Above with the fellows around the table.
Thank you.
What does it mean, this life, this day and night?
So I'm Norman Lear, and you can find me, should you wish to hunt me down, You can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Norman Lear.
And you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Gitt.
And life is good, and space and time. Give me some of yours, I'll give you some of mine.
Don't miss the debut episode of The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner and his very first guest, Adam Sandler.
I was shooting Little Nicky, and my father came to the set. You heard about this new Krispy Kreme donut? And then I'm eating like two or three and talking to him, and he's like, how many are you going to have? I said, that's it. And he's like, you do that every day?
Download new episodes of The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner every Thursday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts. Make sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts.